Please tell me your name and your service in World War II.
Elwood S. Wilson. My military name was under Shirley E., but my Social Security is Elwood S. Wilson. And I started out serving as a Naval Aviation Cadet. December 3rd, 1942 is when I enlisted as a V-5 Naval Aviation Cadet.
When did you arrive in the Pacific Theater?
January of 1945, we landed at Brisbane, Australia. Prior to that, we'd been in the British Admiralty Islands. We were there for 6 weeks. I was on a submarine advanced training crew, and the temperature there was 112 to 118 every day, and they kept us there only about 6 weeks. And then we went down through the Coral Sea and landed at Brisbane, Australia. Then we got on a train and we went down through Sydney and Melbourne and Kalgoorlie and went all the way around the continent in Australia by train and came out at Perth, Australia. That was the capital of Western Australia. And then we were stationed at Fremantle Harbour. That was right near Perth, Australia. And that was our submarine base in the Indian Ocean. And then I was there for, oh, 3, 4 months. And then it was the end of June or the 1st of July that
Of what year? I'm
of
sorry.
45 that I was assigned to a submarine, USS Croker, SS-246. And we made a war patrol then in the China Sea off the Philippine Islands. And that's how I won the Philippine Liberation Ribbon then.
Tell me what was involved in war patrol. What was life like on the submarine? What happened when you were on patrol?
Three men had to sleep in two sacks, and you'd have 8 hours on, and then you'd be off. And the man that got in the sack the last that time, then it was 8 hours, he'd be getting up, and you'd get in there. Hot sacking, we called it. On our cruise, we went through the Lombok Straits in Indonesia, going up to in the China Sea off the Philippine Islands. And while we were at sea, another submarine contacted us, and they had sunk a sampan, and that was a Japanese sailing vessel that was hauling fuel oil and rice, and they were headed to Borneo to give fuel to their tanks and jeeps or trucks and whatnot, and rice for the troops to eat. They sunk the sampan, the other ship did, with their 5-inch deck gun. And they took six Chinese off the ship, and they took two Malayan boys, and there had been two Japanese officers on there. But the one Japanese officer believed what he read in the Japanese imperial newspaper, that Americans would not take prisoners. So he drove overboard, and the boarding party had small arms, and one of them opened up on the Jap out in the sea. And the rest of them opened up too. They all wanted to shoot their firearms, so they just riddled that one Japanese and put him back on board and buried him there at sea. Then this whole unit was put on our submarine, and I believe the reason this other submarine then must have been going back to our submarine base in Fremantle, Australia, and evidently we were going to go to Subic Bay in the Philippines, and they had a prisoner of war camp there. So I think that's why they transferred these prisoners on our ship. And the one Japanese that we took as prisoner, we chained him up in the forward torpedo room. And he was there for about almost 2 weeks before he finally spoke. And he'd been in the United States. And he had been a tennis player, I think, in the Berlin Olympics. And he was number one tennis player, so he said, in Japan. And it was 6 years since he'd been home. One ensign on our ship on the submarine asked him, he said, "You know where Texas is?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "One of 48 states in the United States." And the ensign went down through the ship. He said, "That Jap's not so dumb after all. He knows where Texas is." And then he told us he hadn't been home in 6 years. And another one said, "That Jap's homesick just like we are." The reason he didn't speak, because he was so angry that we shot the other officer. Then we found out then that he wanted to go home real bad. And we told him that if he got in a prisoner of war camp at Subic Bay, he'd probably get home before we would. They'd transfer him back to Japan eventually. Then the two Malayan boys that we took on board, Johnny Goh was the name of one of them, and I became pretty well acquainted with him. And a lot of our boys thought, well, they're just gooks. He had been educated in Singapore at a British school, and there they went 10 years. In the British Empire, there's so many holidays that they didn't have summer vacation. They went the year round for 10 years. And that was the equivalent of a high school education in our country. And I said, "Down, he speaks Chinese, speaks Japanese, and speaks English." I said, "We should be that dumb." The other submarine had taken all of their possessions off of the sampan before they sunk it with their 5-inch deck gun. And he had all kinds of Japanese invasion currency. And this is what the Japanese had been paying them. And the 6 Chinese and the 2 Malayan boys, if they didn't return, we asked them why they hadn't subdued the 2 Japanese officers on board. And they said if they didn't return home, they would retaliate against their families. And that's why the 6 Chinese were working like they were, and these 2 Malayan boys. I asked this Johnny Goal, I said, when the Japanese invaded Singapore, why didn't you resist? He said, we had no firearms. And I said, well, how come? He said, in the British Empire, if you were caught with a firearm, it was a death penalty. And I realized then that the time I was born, the sun never set on the British Empire, and that's how they controlled them. And a good example of that is in England, the bobbies, up until the terrorists started in here in recent years, never even carried firearms. Now they do. And in Australia, they voted through to take away their firearms, and they voted the same thing in Canada. And that's 2 nations that are part of the United Kingdom now, that once was controlled completely by England. And that's how they dominated all their places, countries that in the world that they occupied. I was on board the submarine then August the 6th when they dropped the first atomic bomb at Hiroshima. And it rocked our boat so that one of my shipmates that was in the cook's galley, the boat took such a slant that it threw him towards the bulk wall in the cafeteria. And he put up his hand to stop the fall, and he broke his wrist. And that's how violent that bomb was working in the ocean.
How close were you to Hiroshima?
Near the Philippine Islands. We were quite a ways away.
So you were quite a ways away, yeah.
I'm sure. On August 8th, they dropped it on Nagasaki, the second bomb. We didn't feel that one quite as much on the sub. By August 15th, we were acting as an anchor at one time. We were anchored at a certain location on the ocean, and army planes would fly over us. And there was a string of subs and naval ships along the way that they'd used to navigate flying into the Philippines. When the war ended, this Johnny Goh went through the submarine and he had this stack of Japanese currency. And of course, his uncle was a banker in Singapore. And like he said, all the merchants in Singapore, the Japanese would come in and buy their goods and give them the Japanese invasion currency. When Japan surrendered then, August 15th, he came through the ship and he handed out some of his Japanese invasion currency. He said, here, take some, no damn good no more. And I thought that was one thing that I remember from World War II. I thought that was so comical. He was smart enough, he knew that paper was just worthless when the Japanese lost the war.
Were you surprised by some of the things you learned from having these prisoners on board?
I was certainly surprised. I talked a lot to Johnny Goh. I thought he was a very intelligent young man. We couldn't talk to Chinese, of course, because all they knew was Chinese. And we fed them rice, white rice like we'd cook it, you know. They didn't seem to know what it was, so I don't know how they prepared their rice. It certainly must have been different from ours. And this one Japanese officer then, told us then how he'd been in the United States at one time, too. So he was a well-educated Japanese. And that was something that surprised everyone, that he hadn't been home in 6 years, and he was as homesick as some of our troops were.
Can you tell me what happened? Did that happen over the course of a day or several days? Or what took place to liberate the Philippines?
That started, I think, in October of 44. It took several months. And there were still Japanese troops holdouts in the island at the time. My submarine, then, when the war was over, we came into Subic Bay. That's a big bay there in the north of Manila. Of course, all these prisoners that we had, the Chinese weren't actually prisoners. They were forced to work the same way with these 2 Malayan boys. And the one Japanese, of course, was truly a prisoner of war. They wouldn't let us go in to Manila. It was pretty well torn up, and they pretty well kept us in Subic Bay. And we had a camp there called Camp Dewey. Certain numbers of us each day got to go off the USS Howard W. Gilmore was the ship that I was put on when we came into Subic Bay. And all submarine sailors that had more time than I, there was I and several others, were put off the sub and transferred onto the sub tender. So some of the ones that had more time in got onto the USS Croker, the submarine that I served on. And it was August 31st, just 16 days after I was put on Howard Gilmore, that we set sail for New York for Navy Day. It was in October, I think. Now it's they're all under Armed Forces Day, but then you still celebrated Navy Day. We set anchor, pulled anchor up, and we stopped at Pearl Harbor. And when we got there, the USS Croker that I'd been on was anchored there, had been assigned to Pearl Harbor. Temporarily, I suppose. But at any rate, I thought that was fortunate that I got off of it, because our ship headed to San Diego, and there were hundreds of people out on the dock there when our ship docked there, cheering us and everything, and it felt really good. And I could have taken my leave then to go home, but I stayed on the ship because they were going to go down through the Panama Canal, going into the Atlantic. So I went through the Panama Canal, and then we anchored in the Hudson Bay River off of New York. In a Navy Day, on a destroyer, Renshaw, President Truman, I was looking out a porthole and could see him there. He was dressed in a gray suit with his hat on. He was standing up there on the deck, and the destroyer went down the Hudson, went by a row of naval ships that were stationed there. And the USS Howard W. Gilmore that I was on was one of them. And then later on, we were assigned to Pier 10 in Statenville Island, and that's where I was then until about February, I guess, of 46. And I had gone several times to naval stations and checking, because I there's times that my sense of equilibrium was real bad.
Oh, your equilibrium?
Equilibrium. When I got back home on leave, I think it was in January, I went to Dr. Nilsson in Sioux Falls here. He had operated twice. I'd had two mastoid operations on my right ear, one when I was 7 and one when I was 11. And he examined me, and he said, well, he said, you've got a tumor in your right maxillary sinus. He said, I can't do anything, because he said, you're in the Navy. He said, I wouldn't dare touch you. He said, you tell them when you get back to the ship. All the times they'd examined me in the Navy, and a couple of times when, in Australia, the doctors there weren't skilled in that, and they didn't know
that
I had that.
They didn't see it.
So then I went back and told the ship's doctor on the USS Howard W. Gilmore, and he said, well, keep this on the QT, but he said, we're going to go to Key West, Florida. We're going to be assigned there in March. And he said, there's a naval hospital there where they've got head and eye and ears and nose, throat specialists. And he said, we'll send you over there as soon as we get there. So I guess it was about somewhere near the 1st of March. And so I had a major sinus operation there. I was there 6 weeks in Naval Key West Hospital. And at the time that I was leaving there, I think it was about 3rd or 4th of April, something like that, I was in a poker game. And I was an up patient, too. After about 2 weeks, I could go down to Key West on a bus touring the Key West, Florida there. And I remember there, one restaurant served turtle steak from these big 200 or 300 pound sea turtles. I'd never eaten such delicious steak in all my life. It's like beef. The steers there, they've got a lot of muscle in their meat. There's no muscle in the center of a big ocean turtle. And they had turtle steak and turtle soup. At one time there, when I was outpatient, I had a chance to go on a deep sea fishing deal where they were taking them out and catch swordfish and I don't know what all kinds of big sea fish that they had, that you had a chance to do that. It cost thousands of dollars now, I guess, to get a trip like that. But Dr. Munson was the one that had operated on me there, and he liked to play tennis, and I had been playing tennis for years before I went in service. So I turned that trip down and stayed and played tennis with him one afternoon. I've always regretted that, the chance to have gone deep sea fishing.
Oh, sure. So it sounds like your experience during the war was it was service and you're on a submarine, but you're talking a lot about people that you kind of learned from and experiences or opportunities that you kind of had or didn't have or as a result of your service. Was that part of the experience for you?
Well, yes, and that a lot of people in other countries, like in Australia. I became acquainted at Perth, Australia, with Sergeant Keith Gray. He was in the Royal Australian Air Force, and he flew Spitfires there from an air base that was right near Perth. And of course, the war had ended already then when I was there. It ended in Europe, but it was still going on in the Pacific. And I was amazed that he told us he'd never driven a car in his life, yet he trained to be a pilot and was flying Spitfires. Out of Australia.
That's kind of funny.
I really liked Australia. They would say, "I say there, old chap, can you spare a bloody butt?" They were all begging for American cigarettes. And some of them would say, "Oh, she's a bloody war, old Yank, isn't she?" And one night, my buddy and I were walking down the street in Perth when we'd get to Liberty off of our submarine base. We got down to about halfway down the block, and way at the other end of the street, out in the intersection, there was a whole bunch of American sailors and British sailors. And there was a Yank, like they call them, and a Limey is what they call the English. They were out there in the center having a fist fight. And we went by in front of one establishment there. There was a lady standing out there, and she says, "Well, what's going on now?" And the next businessman says, "Oh, another Yank and a Limey are at it again." And by the time we got up there, one of our patrol wagons had come in, and they got out with their billy clubs and chased them all away, and they grabbed that one American sailor and threw him in the paddy wagon and took off. And we found out later, 5-6 blocks later, they let him out, and they had pulled him out of there. They didn't want the whole crew to get in a fight, the whole crowd,
oh,
to see.
Sure, sure.
So they broke it up right now.
Uh-huh.
So I always had a big feeling for Australia. We were in a pub one time, and one Yank sailor, he keep calling them Yanks instead of Americans. They always called us Yanks. He was having a fight with an Aussie soldier, and he'd been shooting off his mouth that the Aussies weren't any good and they weren't any fight kind of fighters. And this Aussie was beating him up, though. And we had about 5-1 of our sailors that were in there compared to what the English sailors were there. And nobody offered to help that because most of us liked the Australians. And we knew that they had been doing a lot of the fighting, especially up in New Guinea with our American soldiers. My brother had been there with the 147th Field Artillery out of Sioux Falls. They were an artillery unit that was backing the Australian and the American forces there in New Guinea.
So you had a brother who was serving as well. Did you have any other siblings who were serving too?
No, just my older brother.
Your older brother.
He got called up in October 1940. They activated the 147th Field Artillery out of Sioux Falls and sent them to Fort Ord, California. And they were just out there in their squad tents living out in the sand. A couple of years ago, we went by Fort Ord out in California now. It stretched for I don't know how far, barracks and everything. It was all closed up, though, now. When he went there in 1940, they were out in tents. Mm-hmm. That's what was Fort Ord was to begin with.
So they were activated before the U.S. entered the war.
Yes, Roosevelt, a lot of people don't know that. Pearl Harbor, there were B-17s flying in during the attack, and they weren't armed. Some of them got shot down by the Japanese. And a lot of people didn't know that we had B-17s and we had SB Dauntless torpedo bombers on the aircraft carriers. Roosevelt had evidently been arming our naval and the army, preparing them for war.
So he knew it. Well, I'm sure a lot of people feared or knew it was coming eventually.
Yeah.
So.
And my brother got home in October or November of 41 from Fort Ord. And when the war started, they were at sea, headed for the Philippine Islands. And when the war broke out, December 7th, then they couldn't go in there, and they were out on the sea over the deck seats, painting over the name of their ship and whatnot. And they landed in Brisbane, Australia. And they were the first foreign troops that had ever landed in Australia and put up the American flag at Brisbane. That was on the northeast coast of Australia.
So your brother was in, he was your older brother, he was in for much longer than you.
Yes, and yeah. He didn't get home till about when I was getting ready to go overseas in October, November of 44 is when he got home. He'd been gone almost 4 years.
What would you like those people to know, either about World War II or about your particular experience?
Well, I'm glad that I volunteered in December 3rd of 42. I had a lot of experiences of 17 months as a naval aviation cadet, and then I was 15 months in submarines and the last 8 months on surface craft. And I had a lot of good experiences and had some buddies that were killed in different places. It was a war well worth fighting for, and I'm glad that we won it both in the Pacific and the Atlantic.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Pray for the soldiers now that are in Baghdad. They say that they got about 80 pounds of equipment with all their body armor, and they wouldn't dare take that off, and they have to go on patrol down the streets carrying this equipment in 110 degrees of heat. Pretty hard for anyone to imagine kind of a strain that must be on a man carrying 80 pounds of equipment in that kind of heat, and never knowing when there might be roadside bombs that they can detonate when you get near them, or same way when you're driving in vehicles. Real tough type of warfare that they're fighting. I know we went through that and our troops in Normandy, and was real bad, and all the battles in the Pacific, there were a lot of Marines and Army people that were killed and taking different islands. So there was terrible battles there too. And I just hope that people will appreciate what our service people are doing now in Iraq, and will give them full support.
Was there a day when you were in service when you felt particular fear? Do you remember the day that you were maybe afraid the most, or a day when you thought, oh man, I can't wait to not be in this submarine? Or did you ever have a day like that?
Well, there was one day when we thought a Japanese plane had come over. We dove down to about 100 feet. I was at the helm then, and the commanding officer, the officer on duty, that said, full left rudder. And I said, full left rudder, sir. And so you see, if there was only one plane coming in, you could either go to the left or to the right or straight ahead. And they could only bomb in one direction. If they did drop a bomb, they must have gone straight ahead, because we went to the left. So that would give you kind of a fear, the knowing that someone maybe is coming in to bomb you. But there's only the one instance where there was ever any time where I could really say that I might have been afraid a little bit.
I understand, Elwood, you were one of 20,000 cadets who wasn't allowed to complete the training because the U.S. was training more pilots than were getting killed. So tell me how it felt to not be able to do what you really wanted to do.
It was sure a big disappointment at the time. Of course, pilots got 20% of their base pay in the same way submarine sailors. In Australia, $120, that was about 40 pounds in our money. And there's all kinds of, there was British submarines there too at this base. Some of our boys really run them down. They'd say, walk you limey bastards. Some of our boys would go together and take a taxi, or you could ride the bus. But they got about 6 pounds a month, and I was getting 40.
Wow.
They were vastly underpaid according to our armed forces.
Well, is there anything else, Elwood, or do you feel like...
No, that's probably plenty.